Five, four, three, two, one.
What's the situation, Captain?
This is Situation Fluxus, a weekly one-hour program focused on jazz and improvised music, news, radio, conversations, and more. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. Let us dig into the headlines. Events happening this evening, Thursday, November 3rd. Vocalist Terry Rozier with Sharp 5 perform at Jazz in the Lounge in Woodstock, New York, 7:30 p.m. For more information, bearsvilletheater.com. In Chicago, Illinois, at the Hungry Brain, the Dalawari Landgraf Quintet, 9 p.m. CST. For more information, hungrybrainchicago.com. At the Stone in New York City, Scenes from La Boloniste, 8:30 p.m. For more information, thestonenyc.com. At Elastic in Chicago, Illinois, Reed player Keith Jackson's Likely So, starting at 8:30 p.m. CST. For more information, elasticarts.org. Saxophonist Owen Broder tours behind his new Outside In Music release, Hodges, Front and Center, Volume 1. He and his quintet perform at the Earshot Jazz Fest Royal Room in Seattle, Washington. For more information, owenbroder.com. Trumpeter Michael Sarian's Living at the End of the World tour continues at the Sound Bank in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. For more information, michaelsarian.com. The South Jersey Jazz Society presents a celebration of life and legacy of jazz guitarist Pat Martino at this year's Jazz at the Point Festival, which runs tonight through Sunday, November 6th at Gateway Playhouse and Gregory's Restaurant in Summers Point, New Jersey. The four-day event will feature more than 30 artists, including guitarists Peter Bernstein, Cheryl Bailey, Mark Whitfield, Russell Malone, and Dave Stryker. For more information, southjerseyjazz.org. Drummer Duduka de Fonseca and Brazilian All-Stars perform live at Keystone Corner, Baltimore this Friday, November 4th through Sunday, November 6th. For more information, keystonecornerbaltimore.com. Pianist Jason Yeager continues his tour in celebration of his release, Unstuck in Time, the Kurt Vonnegut Suite, on Saturday, November 5th, at the Washington Heights Jazz Festival in New York City. For more information, jasonyeager.com. Tonight through Sunday, November 6th, at SF Jazz in San Francisco, California, Grammy-winning vocalist Lisa Fishery with the South Carolina-based band Ranky Tanky. For more information, sfjazz.org. At Birdland in New York City, inside of Birdland Theater tonight through Sunday, November 6th, the Mingus Dynasty for two sets each night. And on Sunday, November 6th, vocalist Alexis Cole. And inside of Birdland Jazz Club tomorrow night, Friday, November 4th, the Birdland Big Band. And on Saturday, November 5th, vocalist Nicole Zaratis. For more information, birdlandjazz.com. Jazz this Sunday at the Falcon in Marlborough, New York, as part of the Jazz Coalition series, saxophonist Tim Byrne and guitarist Greg Belize-Chai's Mars. For more information, liveatthefalcon.com. Drummer Tani Tabal and his trio perform at the Lace Mill in the West Gallery on Sunday, November 6th, 4 p.m. in Kingston, New York. For more information, bizio@earthlink.net. At the Kumbwa Jazz Center in Santa Cruz, California, on Monday, November 7th, Shift, led by drummer Antonio Sanchez and Bad Hombre. For more information, kumbwajazz.org. Also on Monday, multi-instrumentalist Joe McPhee's Not Birthday Celebration takes place at Quinn's in Beacon, New York. Today, the Poughkeepsie, New York resident turns 83. For more information, quinsinbeacon.com. And now for new and upcoming releases. Organist John Paul McGee's Gospel Jazzical, Volume 1, live on Jazz Urbane. Woodwindist Josh Sinton's Four Freedoms on FIP. The Chicago Plans for New Zealand on Not Two, and the Clarinet Trio's Transformations and Further Passages on Leo, both out tomorrow, Friday, November 4th. And coming out on Monday, November 7th, guitarist Bill Frizzell's Four on Blue Note, and pianist Hilario Duran and David Varelis's Front Street Duets on Alma. All news items have been gathered from various media sources. For the latest updates, contact the source, venue, or business. Remember, I'm just the messenger. My guests are saxophonist, composer, bandleader, and scholar Timo Volbrecht and drummer Dion Sug. Both are members of Volbrecht's ensemble Fly Magic that draws from the lineages of jazz, post-rock, new and experimental music. Their new release on Bertalk Records is titled Givers and Takers. Okay. So I want to thank you both for joining me here on Situation Fluxus.
Thanks for having us.
Yes.
Yeah.
Timo and Dion, you received your PhD and master's respectively from New York University. Did you two meet there?
Dion, did we? I don't think we did meet there, actually.
I don't think so. I think we met after we graduated.
Yeah, because we weren't there at the same time. I was there a little earlier, and I think you actually arrived when I was leaving.
Right, I was there from 12 to 14, so.
Yeah, I was there from 10 to 12, and then from 14 on to do my PhD. Yeah.
What was the general vibe and attitude surrounding Fly Magic as you recorded your third release, Givers and Takers, while on tour?
Dion? What was the vibe?
Well, it was because, I mean, it was all nice, I thought. It's just because all four of us are all friends. You know, I just had a fun time, you know? I never thought of it like tour. It was just hang and, you know, playing music, making music together. Super fun.
Yeah, it was the first tour after the pandemic, so we had been kind of closed away for such a long time, and it was like a 14-day tour or something like that. And in Europe, we played in Germany, France, Austria, and Ukraine, and it was almost
20 days, right?
It was like, yeah, it was two good weeks, two in a little bit, I think. Yeah, and it was just so special to be able to make music for people. And we the music was all new. I had written the music and I brought it in basically for the tour. So we really, we rehearsed very minimal and really shaped the music on stage. Every night sounded different. And then toward the end of the tour, we went into the studio for 2 days and recorded this. And I think it kind of captures the chemistry between the musicians that developed over the tour. So yeah, I had a great time.
Would you name the two other players in Fly Magic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have Keisuke Matsuno on the guitar and Elias Stemmeseder on the keys. He plays piano and synthesizers.
Now, interestingly, Givers and Takers is the name of a bar in Brooklyn, New York. How did you approach the owners about using their name for the title of your album, Timo?
I didn't.
Oh, there was. Where is it? Where's the bar?
It's Iguanas. It's where Keisuke always has his birthday parties.
Oh my God, really? Wow.
Yeah.
So they do know now, don't they? Or you don't know if they know?
I haven't told them. It's a good reminder. I'm gonna drop by there. I hope they'll be flattered.
Maybe, you know what? I'd carry like a copy of the release.
Yeah, I will do that. I hope I'm not gonna run into any copyright issues there. No one knows.
They'll know by this show.
Yeah.
Timo, you express in the press release that, quote, music is first and foremost a social praxis. In this sense, I understand praxis to mean engagement.
Yeah, basically doing, you know, kind of a multi-layered idea of doing. Like it's what we do, human beings making sounds, coming together.
Would you please expound on the idea of a social praxis in the context of jazz and improvised music performance?
Sure. So the reason why I mentioned this is because the typical way of learning an instrument, at least in the West, or at least I'm from Germany originally, maybe Dion, maybe you have the same experience or not, but you learn music and you focus on all like the what they call intrinsic elements like harmony, melody, rhythm, and maybe a little bit of timbre or like instrumentation. But we learn music and a lot of times we don't learn about the context of the music. At the same time, we all make music in context. You know, we come together, we play a concert with or for an audience. We meet for jam sessions at people's homes or in the city. And so we, in like the analytical world and the education world, a lot of times music is treated in a vacuum. And I'm highly opposed to that because to me, the actual interactivity of the musicians making the music forms the inner fabric of the music itself. So when I put this band together, what Diane just said, like I wanted my friends to be together because it creates a kind of trust and you know, also you can be vulnerable with people that you know very well. So I just, you know, that was really important to me. And then also, especially after, you know, after this experience of being locked down during the pandemic, I really noticed how important the community aspect of making music is. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Dion, if you feel similar.
Yeah, definitely. And I just, you know, after you mentioned about that was like pretty much the first tour after pandemic, after like was like 2 years, right? It was pretty much like at least a year and a half of lockdown or no traveling, or you know, it was tricky. But then the first tour, and then it felt like, I don't know, the way you explained, it's exactly how I felt,
right? In Living by What You Say, Timo, your dissertation explores the collaborative nature of working in the recording studio of ECM founder Manfred Eicher. Did your experience watching him at work give you pause to evaluate the way you approach working in the studio.
Yeah, absolutely. Part of one writing or dissertation is you have to be very interested in the topic yourself. Otherwise, you're not going to survive that. I got really into it. I grew up with ECM recordings. A lot of them are my favorite records that I listen to. They are partly responsible for me becoming a musician. So for me, it was just an incredible honor to be connected to Manfred Eicher and ECM and observe three recording sessions and really watch a master at work and also see the collaborative and interactive process in the studio. And there were several things that I think I really took with me and also maybe applied it to this recording, especially in the mixing process. There are some very detail-oriented things. Like, for example, when you mix, and just for those of you, for the listeners who have never been in a studio mixing, a lot of times you go into the studio with a mixer and you accompany the session and he asks you, oh, how do you like it? Like, do you want any ideas? Do you want the sound a certain way? And then you mix the levels. So a certain instrument, it was being made louder and softer, et cetera. And one of the things that I learned from my time observing ECM is that the entrances of a new instrument are really important. So let's say Dion hasn't played for a little bit and then she comes in. A lot of times, the volume, like we push up the volume a little bit just for the first two notes. So because it's like an event. Mm-hmm. And those are like little intricacies that that I thought were so interesting, but also so effective. Mm. Yeah. And then also the way he works with like the spatial elements of music. So how much or what kind of reverberation to put on to the mix and things like that.
Dion, in this situation, in this experience, what did you come away feeling with the way that Timo directed the studio?
Let me recall, because it's been a year. So when I did a recording session last year with Timo, it was very interesting because every time, most of the sessions, pretty much like the other recording session that I participated, the process would be like, you know, record a, let's say we're recording first track, then we would do it twice or three times and then, you know, talk about like how we want to do this part, maybe like do this part better or this section better. And we would talk about this and then try to fix it. Like the process will be pretty much like that. But with Timo, Fly Magic, it was like we were pretty much like every take will be slightly different, like even the approach or different tempo, different dynamics or different, I don't know, like we literally improvised like every single track, I thought. And then it was really fun. Every time we play something was like very interesting to play and at the same time very nervous because it's only one take and we cannot use other source, like borrow source from other track, you know, other take or, you know, stuff like that. So it has to be right away, and we would pick one version, like our favorite version out of that whatever 3-4 takes of different, like same music but different track. Right. So it was like really interesting. I thought it was really interesting process. I don't know if Timo intended it.
I think it had to do also with the way we were developing that kind of music, because since we were exploring the material each night in a different way on our tour, we kind of brought that vibe into the studio of like keeping things flexible, right, and being open to surprise and to a real improvisation, as opposed to making a pop record where everything's pre-planned. Right. There are pros and cons to that. As Dion said, it's hard to borrow from a different take when something goes wrong. And you know, an edit. In fact, actually there's one take, I'm not going to say which one, or I can, but where things kind of fell apart. And we actually, Dion was in Korea, but Case Gillies and I, we went into the studio and did an overdub session. to fix the
you
tape.
You did? I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah.
We're learning so many secrets right now.
I know. I could tell you. It's actually the title. It's the title track, Givers and Takers. So because Dion was completely isolated in the sonically in a booth in a different room, because drums are loud and they bleed into other mics, we actually kept, the only thing we kept in the middle part was Dion, and we overdubbed
oh my God.
A totally new set. Yeah, you should yeah, listen for it.
You guys were listening to my playing over and over.
Well, we did. It didn't take a long time. It took like half an hour, maybe.
I'm glad.
Well, Dion, I've read that you are fluent in swing, Latin, Eurojazz, and classical drumming. Is that classical music drumming or classical drumming?
I mean, to be honest, like, that's, first of all, thanks for saying that, Timo. I wish I can do, and I'm trying to do it. What Timo wanted to say or explain was I'm, like, open to, you know, I'm not trying to limit myself between genres. Like, classical drumming, I wouldn't say I was trained classically, or, you know, classical snare drum, or, you know, that timpani or other, you know, classical instruments, but I really, I'm open-minded. I'm trying not to. Yeah, I'm trying to learn all different kind of music, even if it's like classical music or Korean traditional music, swing music, Latin, you know, that's my mindset. And I think that's what Timo's impression of me.
So how do you practice and prepare for the unexpected in improvised music?
Wow. That's a good question. How do I practice that? How do I prepare? I don't know. For me, I obviously I cannot practice or prepare for the music that I'm going to play on the stage, but I try to learn, like, especially for Timo's music, I really try to learn melody first and try to get inspired from that, first of all, myself, and then be ready to grasp it from Keisuke or Timo or Elias is playing and trying to have a conversation musically on the stage or in the recording studio. Yeah, I think open-minded mindset would be what I can be prepared for the improvised music. That's, I don't cool. know, what would you say, Timo?
That's such a, I'm really happy I didn't have to answer for us, because it's such a happy question. It's a really good question, Cheryl.
It is a good question.
And I was like, what would I say to this? But I think it's when you come up as a musician, you learn. I think it's so important to play a lot with your friends and peers, and then also with very different people, so you don't always do the same thing. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. And then also, I think it's important to be open to and learn how to be open to to like break routines, you know, especially in jazz. Like there, you go to jam sessions, it's like, oh, you know, you have a rhythm section with a tenor saxophone, maybe trumpet and piano, bass, drums, and it's always like first solo tenor player, second solo trumpet, third solo piano, bass, trading with drums, head out. And and you still do, like, you go to a jam session and that's still the template, and there's nothing wrong with it, but sometimes it's like, why don't you start with the bass solo, you know, or why don't two players play together at the same time, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like these things and experimenting with these things. And the last thing I will say to this is, I think it's also really important not to fall in love too much with your own ideas.
Wow, that's
yeah.
Because if you do, you stick to them. And especially as an, so for me, I wrote the music for this record, right? But I invited this band to play this music. And I know, even though like I'm officially like the leader on the record or whatever, this is a really democratic project, because I gave, you know, when you write music, you have the ultimate decision to make between how much control do I predetermine and how much control do I give away. So if you have a strong vision and you want the music to sound exactly like this, you have to make a lot of choices before and have them execute the music. Sure. The downside of this, the trade-off, is that it might become inflexible and maybe a little stale. The other extreme is like, you just give a few ideas as a composer and then just let it fly and let it develop. And I don't know, but I think in the case of this music, there's a lot of control that was given to the musicians, and I intended it to be that way, because I knew that the musicians I would be working with are amazing improvisers. So yeah, but it really depends on the kind of music you want to write. But I think that's one way of breaking routines and opening it up for unexpectedness and surprises.
Yeah, well said.
I like that.
Yeah. My last question is about the first two singles that you released from Givers and Takers. Bao, named after your firstborn child, and Happy Happy. I expected Pao to have that upbeat and joyful nature that Happy Happy does, but it doesn't. So I sense that there's more of a story or a journey with Pao. Am I right?
Yeah. So I wrote Pao before he was born. I wrote the tune before. It's his name. Pao, he's 8 months old now, but I wrote the tune kind of waiting for it and expecting it. And it's, you know, this idea of like, I was just, you know, it's a very emotional experience. So there's like this tenderness in there. Mm. If I had known what he's like, I would have probably written a very upbeat tune. and Happy Happy I wrote because I'm a sucker for melancholy. Like, I love writing music with like a tinge of melancholy in it. And I always resort to like these like dark and warm minor chords. And I just like, man, Timo, write a tune that's chipper. That was my my attempt to, you know, I just wanted to write something really chipper. And then it kind of takes a pretty dark turn in the middle on the record and that kind of goes out of it again. But that's where those tunes are coming from.
Okay, that explains it. So as we come to the end of this interview, I want to give the last word to both of you. Is there anything that I didn't ask you? What would you like us to hear from you, either about this release or upcoming projects?
Upcoming project, Timo, maybe?
Yeah, so we're going on tour in April, May. In Europe, it's being booked right now, 2023. Mm-hmm. Gosh, what can we say? We've covered so much. Yeah, it's interesting. This band is really spanning the entire globe, and it's kind of due to the pandemic, but two of us are in Brooklyn. Elias and I, Keiske is in Berlin, Germany. Dion is in Seoul, Korea. Mm-hmm. So it's been, you know, it's a bummer, but it's also really cool to, like, you know, get the people together and play music. Yeah, I don't know. Dion, what would you say, your final words of wisdom?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I look forward to the next journey next year, 2023. And we were talking about having the band touring to Asia and hopefully to Korea. So if that happens, you know, that would be a total new chapter for us. So yeah. I look forward to that and making more music with these people.
And also, if any of your listeners, I know that Hudson, New York is not too far from New York, but we're actually playing a show, unfortunately, without Diane because she's in Korea right now, but we're presenting this music this Sunday in Manhattan. And it's like an invite-only show, but there's still some spots left on the list, so feel free to reach out to me. You find me on the internet. Actually, you can type in fly-magic.com, so fly-magic.com, and just send me an email if you're interested in coming to the show. It's in Manhattan on Sunday evening.
What spot?
It's called Work and Roll.
For more information, timovolbrek.com and fly-magic.com. You're listening to Situation Fluxus on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. Please send your comments, quips, and anecdotes, as well as feedback to thejazzdisturbance@gmail.com. For more information about the show, jazzfluxus.com. Let's hope I don't call you Tim. It's got to be Neil. It's got to be Neil.
I accept anything. As long as I'm getting attention, it's okay.
My interview is with guitarist Neil Hendry, a member of the Canadian group So Long Seven. Their September release is titled Only Elephants Know Her Name. Well, Neil, I'd like to thank you for joining me here on Situation Fluxus.
My pleasure, Cheryl. Lovely to meet you.
Let me ask you the question that I am sure you never get asked.
Sure.
How did the four of you come up with the name for your group?
Well, the real answer is we're not sure, but that means that we make up answers all the time. And sometimes audience members come up with suggested answers. But this sort of simplest sort of model to understand how we don't know, but it does indicate some possibilities, is that there was a previous version of this band called Oolong Seven. And after the membership got adjusted slightly and things changed and sounds changed, by accident, So Long Seven was said out loud at one point, and it kind of stuck. So long to the old and in with the new, because it was the old version was, we were thankful for it. And it was, you know, it's just how things go. But that's as close as I can come to a real answer. The best answer I've heard so far is that we had a member named Stephen, and Stephen, I think at some point he became a magician in this story. And so Stephen the magician was in the band and he left the band. And for some reason, we took the T out of his name and called it So Long Seven. That's the last one I heard Tim say to an audience, and it went over very well.
So how long has this current group been together?
7.5 years, I think. Yeah, 7 to 8 years is very true. Yes, response.
Okay. The inspiration for Only Elephants Know Her Name are quite unusual. Frogs, elephants, an indigenous modernist painter. And could you pronounce her name?
Kanojuak Ashevak.
Yeah, an Inuit artist. Yep. Yeah. Yep. You, along with mandolin, fiddle, and banjo player Tim Poskate, violin and viola player William Lamoureux.
Yep, Lamoureux. Yep, that's Lamoureux. That's very close. Yep.
And Dumbek and percussionist Ravi Nempali.
Yes, and his main instrument is tabla.
Tabla. Yep. You all contributed compositions to this release. Where did the concept start for it?
Well, we had a number of compositions before the pandemic that were slated to go on the next record, which we decided would be happily inevitable. And we were working towards that. We had, you know, like any other band, we had gigs lined up, and we were about to go in and do the normal sort of conventional recording. Then the pandemic hit, and everything stopped, as we all know. And so it gave us we all started recording our parts at home separately, which has its advantages and disadvantages. In our case, it was, in the long term, it was an advantage because the creation of arrangements was slower and more mindful, I guess, to use a buzzword. And with that, the repertoire for the album changed a bit. Some of the songs that were slated to go on it have been postponed to the next one. From that point, we were each submitting songs to each other to try. And the songs that sparked ideas, you know, in terms of arrangement and production, they kind of started, we started working on those first. And as we got two or three of those together, I think that subliminally dictated the arc for the album. And then once they were all there, we sort of discussed and, you know, leave this one out, put this one in, kind of thing. But more or less for the entire album itself, more songs were written and recorded than made it to it. And once a few key songs were in there, those key songs somehow mystically decided who their pals would be on this release. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably like a weird response, but I believe it to be true.
I do not find it weird at all.
Well, thanks, Cheryl. Thank you.
You know, these compositions to me seem quite personal. Mazimhaka,
yeah.
Was written for a dear family friend of yours.
Yeah, the dearest, I would say. Yes.
And Mara, for an elephant who lived in a circus.
She's a little over 50 now. So she started in a circus and then she ended up at a zoo in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, in Argentina. And the zoo became an eco park because there was quite a lot of complaints about treatment of animals there. So the eco park is what's there now. And they have the greatest interests of the animals at heart. But they, with that in mind, they knew they couldn't have elephants there. It wouldn't be that good for them. So there were three elephants, two African elephants and one Indian elephant. And the Indian elephant's name was Mara. And so Mara, the process started to get Mara moved to a sanctuary in Brazil, an amazing sanctuary. It's the global sanctuary for elephants in Brazil. And so I read a New York Times article about, because they started transporting her on land from Buenos Aires to Brazil in July 2020, like the worst time to, you know, go cross borders with an elephant, right? So there was, it caught little videos they were posting of, you know, mishaps and almost mishaps and border crossings forms. And I can't even imagine. By the time I read the article, she had made it. She made it to the sanctuary. And it was amazing to me, this amazing creature. I'm a big elephant fan, but from afar, you know, I don't want to disturb them. But that she had the patience to manage that trip in the container, and that all, like, it was four or five people, I think, who went with her and got her there. It was incredible, and the resilience and the happy landing, because the sanctuary has got a lot of room, and they do a great job at taking care of all the elephants there. The other two African elephants are going to be on their way to the same sanctuary shortly.
Wow, wow. Were these themes floating on the surface for you, or did you have to dig deep for them?
Depending on the song, Mara, I didn't have to dig too deep. No, it was a happy coincidence of a little bit of inspiration and thinking about her, and then a fair amount of editing once the inspiration landed some material, but it was pretty easy. But when Samita added the vocal, that was all her melody and some Sanskrit lyrics in Sanskrit. And so I don't know if she dug deep for that, but it certainly put the song over the top. So, so it was a whole new ball game. So that one, not deep so much. Mazamhaka, a little bit deeper. But yeah. Some of them, the other guys would speak better to how deep they went on each song. But there was a lot of writing and rewriting and that's perfect, and then 2 weeks later, oh boy, it's not perfect. So effectively deep over time, but just back and two steps forward, one step back, and oh, the album's finished. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of the others, I'm thinking of Tim's tune, World Now You're Old. And on it, he plays gourd banjo.
He does beautifully.
It has a folkish lilt to it, but the title seems, there's a message there. Do you happen to know what it is?
I've heard him say it, and so I guess I might know. He says it better than me, so I think I can come close, but definitely something will be wrong with my response. He was thinking of the state of the world, and the state of ourselves. We're old, you know, sort of a global blues, possible unhappiness, acceptance, we're old. And I think because he wrote it with there was some lyrics that went along with it when he was working on it. So those were I don't know them, but I know it because I briefly heard him singing them along when he was sorting it out. And I think that there was a concrete feeling there. It was definitely in one of the lockdowns when it was written, and that sort of isolated doom feeling had to have played a part. But it's one of the brilliant things that Tim writes, and his folk influence is huge. He plays in a variety of jazz and folk and bluegrass groups in Toronto, and it all makes its way in there. I'm no slide guitar player, but he had me playing slide on that and stuff. So he really had an idea what he wanted, and it worked out great. But I think, that's very, very Tim Poskate, the folk edge and the deceptive simplicity, I would say, but very energetic and a welcome song. We were all happy about that one. Yeah.
This is the group's third release.
It is indeed, yes.
How does it fit? How does it sit in So Long Seven's discography? How would you describe it?
I feel like you've done this before, Cheryl. Well, that's a good question. I would describe it as in many ways, it's the most representative of what we've always been going for. The other two albums were very representative of where we were at the time. The first one was there was not a lot of overdubs. It was straightforward, not completely live off the floor, but that was the spirit of it for sure. And there wasn't a lot of, no strings added, no, you know. And that was an accurate, and Samita's on that one too, singing one of Ravi's tunes called Arti. And so it's a little raw, but it did the trick for sure back then. The second one was very interesting because we went to, it was produced by Anthony McKelly, who did a great job. He's a local producer and drummer here in Toronto. And he did a fantastic job of running the sessions and throwing ideas around and making them happen. We were in Hamilton, which is about an hour outside of Toronto, at a studio, and there was a lot of experimentation. They had tons of instruments at that studio, so we really messed around and stuff. And so what that was a more chaotic, a good chaotic version of a way to make a record. And it fleshed out a lot of stuff for us. What can we try? What sounds like, you know, what how does this sound kind of thing? And we got used to, we were fairly young still as a band, so we got used to experimenting and brainstorming together. This third one fits in that it is very much a combination of those two albums and the approaches, but we had the benefit of some lockdowns to slow us down a bit. And William did an incredible job of producing the album and recording the album. He's a brilliant man with incredible ears. And so he steered the ship for sure, as is the producer's job. But we had time to fix mistakes and reinvent things we decided we didn't want to do how they went. And that was great. And when the deadline was coming, it was a shock to lose that privilege of continuing editing, but it was necessary. But definitely this third one carries a carefully sculpted combination of the previous two albums for sure. It's definitely heading the right direction, up instead of who knows where, you know.
I just love listening to the creative process. I just love it. Call me a nerd, but I love to hear artists talk about how they went from here to here to here to here. Boom. Love it.
I believe nerd is a compliment of the highest order. So wear the badge proudly, Cheryl. Yes.
The definition for what So Long Seven performs. Some would probably slap the label of world music upon you.
Yeah.
How does So Long Seven describe what it does?
Really good question. We keep trying to describe what we do. And we sometimes get close. The best description we've heard, but it's not complete, was one reviewer called us cross-cultural chamber music. And I think that's pretty close. And we're a lot of, but the one thing that sneaks its way in all the time is improvisation. But we do have a lot of stuff that isn't improvisation, but once we, a lot of the solos live are improvised. And once we hit the stage and get comfortable, a lot more improvisation happens. And also with our most recent gig, I caused a bit of trouble with some mistakes. And so that caused for some collective solutions through improvisation.
What do you mean? What mistakes?
I misspoke. Ingenious creative choices in which I did not consult anyone but myself.
I see. Thank you for that clarification.
No problem. So it is the cross-cultural chamber music, I think, still is the closest. But really, it's there's an immense number of world elements. What keeps us from being a world music band, I think, is that Ravi is the only one who's has incredible experience and is steeped in a tradition, which is the Indian classical music. And he is absolutely brilliant at that and many other things. The three of us, we've all played a lot of jazz and various forms of music. So we are less worldly in terms of our the background of our studies. What makes the overall sound worldly is that we're all four of us are continually stealing or being inspired from all kinds of musical styles that are usually from far away from Canada. You notice we take a lot from flamenco and things. And we're kind of like cherry picking various influences all the time. So it is a melting pot of countries and styles and things like that. But we've all improvised so much that has to make its way in there. So maybe somewhat improvised cross-cultural chamber music is the best description.
Well, Neil, as we come to the end of this interview, I'd like to give you the last word. Is there something you'd like us to know about you, an upcoming project, or the next So Long 7 release?
No, we're still, the official launch date for ours is in here in Toronto on November 12th at the Revival Bar. And so that's, the full string quartet and Samita will be there singing. So that's the next big thing. And the following release, I believe, is an EP next year that'll feature quite a bit of Samita. We very much appreciate this interview and whoever's listening. Thanks for listening to us and everything else you listen to. And, take care of the elephants, cats, and dear family friends in your lives. And thank you.
For more information, solong7.com. And time left for music. From her debut release on Positone Records this June, Quarantine Dream, here's pianist Kaylee O'Doherty with fellow pianist Oscar Peterson's Blues for Big Scotia. Nicole Glover is on saxophone, Tamir Schmerling is on bass, and Corey Cox is on drums and percussion. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus, produced for and airing on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I've been your host, Cheryl Kay. Tune in next Thursday at 10 a.m. for another show. I also host the Jazz Disturbance on the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th Sunday of each month from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on WGXC, wgxc.org. For more information about Situation Fluxus, thejazzdisturbance at gmail.com or jazzfluxus.com. Thank you.